for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. You're listening to Damian Richardson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to Friday, the 28th of April. I'll just give a shout out to my colleague on before me, Chris Smith, and I say good on you, mate, for having Mark Latham on the show yesterday. You didn't cower under the pressure. I saw a lot of the pressure that was coming onto you on your social media pages, and you stood firm and said, no, I insist that this man continue to have a voice. And it was interesting to me too. Not only did the man have a voice on your show, but he doubled down in many respects, and he still remains a member of the One Nation Party. I'm not quite sure how Pauline feels about that ultimately, and it'll be interesting to watch that space as we go on. But at least you had the courage of your convictions, Chris, to allow the man to come on the show and put across his point of view. And you know full well that the institutions of state and the corporations will want to shut him down, but equally they want to shut him down because a lot of people, they'll be hearing that message and be agreeing with it wholeheartedly. And that's the conundrum that we all face at this juncture. We've been talking about a lot this week. We'll talk about it too when the Cossack comes on. We'll talk about Tucker Carlson's tweet that has got some extraordinary millions and millions of views in a few hours, just blown up the internet quite literally. We'll play the clip, but we'll also actually go to the point of why people, there's so many theories now. I keep hearing, I've heard about 10 or 12 different theories about why they would have removed Tucker Carlson, one of the highest rating anchors on news in the world. But still, that wasn't enough to save him. He was getting 3.5 million viewers a day. So that's, you know, do the maths, it's just under 20 million a week. No one really came close to him in an era when it's very difficult to operate within the mainstream media and still reach an audience. But he still was capable of reaching that audience. I've had some people get in touch with me. They wanted me to do something on the rollout of the 5G towers. Someone's actually told me a specific street, which I won't mention, but in the suburb, Melbourne suburb of Murrumbina, where there's a tower being put in this morning, and much to the angst of the residents, they didn't want the tower to be put in. There was four guys putting this tower in, digging the trench for it anyway, in the video I saw, and there was two guys there in security. To make sure that no one harassed these people while they were digging the trench to put the tower in. It's extraordinary. We're actually at a point where the rollout of infrastructure in this country creates such concern for a number of residents that there would be security involved in the rollout of their infrastructure. It must make it so much more expensive to actually roll out Australia's infrastructure ultimately. But the problem for me is, before I could back any criticism of the rollout of 5G, apart from the obvious one that it's only going to make smart cities that much easier and the ability to entrap us in many respects, if you like, for want of a better word, in these smart cities in the future. And I can understand that's a problem. But I think these people are talking more about the amount of megahertz it radiates, like 26,000 megahertz they radiate, and that causes all sorts of problems for the human body, apparently. But I don't know enough about it. And I know when train lines were rolled out back in the day in the 1800s, people were complaining about railway spine. And railway spine was going to be a thing that was, you know, basically end humanity as we knew it. But as it turned out, now we just get on trains and travel quite comfortably. But I'm not saying that's exactly the same thing for what is happening out there in Murrumbina. But if these people want me to investigate it, then I suggest you get on the website and you put up someone that you would like me to interview. And I'm happy to interview some expert in that field that knows something about what they're talking about, and they could elucidate maybe there's a whole stack of people that are listening to this program right now that would actually like to know more about it, and I'd be happy to be part of that. And my daughter got home last night, and it's great. She's doing this hairdressing apprenticeship, which is wonderful. She's now complaining that she should have stayed at school. And I said, well, I told you, I said stay at school, and you just refused to do any work. And she said, yeah, well, I thought it was tough at the time, but now I have to go to work every single day. I would rather be at school. But she said to me this thing too that happens, which I didn't know anything about, but she says this thing happens between trans community and the Islamic community, and it's that identity politics status. Which one gets the more status? Is it the trans or Islamic? No one's quite sure. And she told me this thing that happens with these hijabi girls who obviously they wear a hijab because they can't show their hair to any men apart from their father or brothers or uncles or who's in that actual household. So what happens, she says, you go into the girls' toilets and all these hijabi girls, they take their hijab off and start doing their hair or just letting it breathe for a bit. I don't necessarily know. But she says the problem is then when trans people come in, because Islam doesn't accept trans. Well, these particular girls, this version of Islam doesn't accept trans, but the trans knows that too. And the trans apparently are quite sheepish in that situation because they don't want to offend Islam. But offending Christianity is all right. But then the hijabi girls are upset that they have to put their hijabs back on because there's actually what they consider to be a man now in a female space. Who's going to talk about that? Who would even know about it unless you had a daughter to come home after a hard day's work and suddenly decide that she wants to give you a rant? And every now and then as a parent, you know, usually the kids are just like, please leave me alone. Don't touch me. If you touch me, that'd be the worst thing ever. Give me some food and I'll just want you out of my face. But then when they say, hey, listen, I've got a lot to talk about, you listen because, you know, it could be the last time you talk to them for a couple of weeks. Do you have a suggestion for a possible guest? See, I thought this was the right one to read out, that you would like to hear on TNT Radio, or perhaps you have a topic you feel we should discuss, then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio.
Breaking news heard here.
It's around the clock update.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, so National Cabinet, whatever National Cabinet is, it's something that was sort of fabricated during the pandemic. They met anyway in Brisbane today. They're going to keep it going to agree a national approach to a range of priorities for Australians. TNT Radio News producer Jeremy Beck has details on this story. Jeremy?
Thanks, Damien. The National Cabinet in Australia, chaired by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and has all the state premiers as members, along with the chief ministers of the Northern Territory and the ACT. According to the federal government, the first ministers had constructive and positive discussions on key national priorities, including health, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the transition to net zero, and strengthening national renters' rights. First ministers agreed the Federation should be a driver for practical and meaningful reform, not a barrier. Now, Prime Minister Albanese, he says, National Cabinet have determined a range of reforms around the theme for a better future for the Federation. We all know that challenge that we have with global inflation, with pressures on our economy, mean that the Commonwealth needs to work with the state and territory governments in cooperative way in order to achieve reform, to achieve our common objectives of lifting the living standards of Australia, creating greater economic opportunities, creating employment, and making sure that no one is left behind. Well, that's our Prime Minister's take, Damien. But the matters that they discussed, I don't see really doing much of anything other than suiting a certain globalist agenda.
Is the National Cabinet even a legitimate body, Jeremy?
Well, it certainly is not in our constitution, of course, because it only was formed back in 2020 in response to COVID, and they've kept it going, as you said. I don't know that it really is legitimate. I'm not a lawyer, so you'd have to ask someone who understands that a bit better than me. But I just think, what are they achieving? I don't have a problem with different jurisdictions meeting together and discussing things, but the problem I have is that they're, how transparent is it? How democratic is it? And what are they actually doing? Are they pushing policies that are going to benefit Australians? Well, clearly not if you read their communications.
Jeremy, sure, there's going to be something. There's going to be one small little iota of help, isn't there, in there for this, in this meeting for to the benefit of Australians?
Some people might benefit individually, but as a whole, it will drag our nation backwards. I see, you know, that the sorts of handouts that government likes to, you know, curry favour with certain voting groups or what have you, you know, some people surely will benefit. For example, the industry that behind this yes vote for an Indigenous voice to Parliament, even though most Aboriginal Australians will be losers from the process, there will be some spruiking this idea And they will certainly benefit very well, but most Aboriginal people won't, most Australians won't.
Jeremy Beck, news producer, thanks very much for that story. You are listening to TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Katie Hopkins.
Diane Abbott, people. Seriously, MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington since 1987. She's the MP that turned up that time with odd shoes on. Do you remember? She had odd shoes on and they were both for one foot. There are so many examples of her being an absolute wombat and yet she gets away with it, frankly, because of her colour. And now she's banging on about racism. She said some remark or other that's upset everybody, which I always think, if you're going to upset anyone, upset everyone. She basically said, in pre-civil rights America, Irish people, Jewish people and travellers were not required to sit at the back of the bus. So essentially no one else knows about racism except for me and other black people. So that really triggered everyone, because if you want to trigger people, then all you have to do is do what Diane Abbott says and say, Jewish people don't know what racism is. She said this was to her own article that she wrote in draft, she said, but really, you know, it's what she actually thought. I wish to wholly and unreservedly withdraw my remarks and disassociate myself with them. How classic is that?
Katie Hopkins on TNT Radio.
From a modest family physician to an internationally recognized champion for medical freedom, Dr. Vladimir Zelenko first discovered the effective treatment for COVID-19, and who then found himself facing vilification instead of congratulation. Before his passing, the Zelenko Foundation was founded to exclusively provide funding to social entities and social activities surrounding education, leadership development, health advocacy, and social, health, and community development. The Zelenko Freedom Foundation believes action and engagement are key to changing the world. Please help us to preserve the courageous legacy of fighting medical tyranny that Dr. Zelenko so valiantly fought for. Help us secure the future. Contribute to our cause or learn more about upcoming events and how you can help us reach our fundraising goal by making a gift in support of Dr. Zelenko's legacy at zfreedomfoundation.org. Find out how you can help and get involved. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
TNT. Good for fans of justice and truth. Good for us.
This is today's News Talk Radio.
This is what we stand for.
TNT.
Okay, my first guest this hour is Stuart Ballantyne. He's a fellow of the Royal Institute of Naval Architects. He has a long list of awards, including winning the Expo Hero of the Year in Australia in 2008. Stuart holds a Master's of Philosophy in Naval Architecture from Strathclyde University, Scotland, and he was awarded an honorary doctorate in science from Strathclyde in 2014 for his services to the maritime industry. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Damien. How are you?
Yes, good to hear you again. Now, there's been a report done by the National Growth Areas Alliance. I didn't even know we had a National Growth Areas Alliance, but apparently we do, that there's our rapidly growing outer suburbs flooding, and this is to do with climate change, of course, and more money needs to be spent on infrastructure. What could possibly go wrong, Stuart?
Well, I think they blame everything on climate change, and also the price of eggs and everything. So we have got a long history of flooding in this country. In the south, the Murray River, I'm a keen student of the history of the Murray River and the paddle steamer era of 160 years ago, when they were carrying 2,000 bales of wool down the Murray with a 20 horsepower paddle steamer. In the flood times, that instead of going around the oxbows are, if anyone doesn't know what that is, it's almost the river turning on itself all the time. But when the floods came, the paddle steamers, which were very shallow draft, they used to actually go straight across. So they would actually do about one third of the distance and arrive at their destination. So the floods at the time were really appreciated. Now, when you go north to the Gulf of Carpentaria, all of the rivers there are exactly the same. They flood so that you actually can't see the river during a heavy rain season. This is the Albert River, the Leichhardt, the Norman River, which leads into the port of Corumba. So this has been going a long time. But what happens with the suburban creep is that the Greens' aversion to dredging, because what we normally do on with a navigable river, that we dredge the seaward side of the river to keep the navigation depth down and to also keep the flood potential away. But on the upper part of the river, they would dam it. So the fact that we haven't done this, and the urban creep is going all over the place, we're now seeing the results where people are saying, oh, no, we get flooded out, we're getting flooded out, but it's actually of our own making.
This is a case of the fact that local government just, they've allowed developers to come in here and build these suburbs, and now these suburbs clearly need amenity, and so they're just basically suing the federal government to pay for that amenity.
Yes, that's partly the reason, but it's when they allow, the councils are so happy at getting more residences around because they get more rates, more revenue, and more importance. But of course, the water has to run somewhere. And if you actually block the river up with no dredging, for instance, what will happen is that the water won't drain away as fast as it should. And it results in suburban flooding. And we're seeing a lot more of this now, but no one's actually done the flooding models. When they give the permits for doing all these real estate areas with 700, 8,000, 2,000, 4,000 dwellings, no one actually does that part of the checking. And local councils are really at their own worst enemy.
Claire O'Neill, the Home Affairs Minister, has said this week that she's going to offer 2.1 million more temporary visas to migrants in view of giving them an opportunity to actually stay permanently in the country. It's just this exponential growth that it's impossible for any country's infrastructure or demands on their infrastructure to deal with.
Yes, I mean, it's all very well saying, yes, we'll bring all these people in already. There's a huge shortage of housing and accommodation. I'm up here in Southeast Queensland, of course, and you can't get houses or flats within reason. I mean, they're all very expensive now, and a lot of people are finding it tough, even finding it hard to locate even sort of substandard housing. So I don't know what we're going to do with Ms. Claire O'Neill's ambitions about getting lots of more people here.
So it's just part of the capture, isn't it? The whole bureaucracy is captured by the same thing. This report I'm talking about, I read it in an article by the ABC, so the ABC is captured by it. I see someone from the RMIT has come out, the universities are captured by it and said how important it is that this money is invested in Australia's future. It's just a boondoggle of all levels of government, and it's not just government either, is it? There's corporations that are in on it as well.
Well, if corporations can figure out the way, and they're usually quite fast at figuring out the way how to tap into government grants, government programs, they will love it. If you can get your snout into the trough, as a lot of these people end up doing and love doing it, because with government money, usually it's not very accountable. And you get so many people running down, following, it's like the Pied Piper. When the government's going along, giving money for this and giving money for that, yes, there's lots of people following.
And it's contradictory as well, too, as this stuff so often is, because they're saying there's just this need for major freeways, a host of major freeways, particularly in Victoria and New South Wales, but also in Western Australia and South Australia, and roads. Wouldn't that be a problem if the concern is climate change? Isn't the thing they're always telling us is that we have to reduce our reliance on, you know, that sort of transport?
Well, you certainly should, but, and this is part of the amazing ignorance about our coastal highway, the Blue Highway, which is unused, and we don't need to fill in the potholes here, and certainly if we had followed the motorways of the sea model of Europe, we would take a lot of this traffic off of the coastal roads, and that would reduce the demand for more highways and byways, et cetera. So we just don't seem to be focused, well, the government doesn't seem to be focused on logical expansion. We seem to get stuck. You know, we're a trucking nation, and we're myopically focused on trucks. Railways, not so much, but, you know, now they've figured out, okay, well, railways may help it. So now the Melbourne to Brisbane line that was supposed to save us all, they've now found that, of course, they can't take the containers off of the railway line at Acacia Ridge in Brisbane because the river is no longer navigable because of no dredging. Hello. And it's a left hand not doing what the right hand's doing. This is government all over. And there's so many departments, as you mentioned there, Damien. This is an organization I've never heard of that you're talking about. So amazing.
Well, it wants its own minister to government, this organization. That's ultimately where the article ends, is in a plea that this organization should be given its own minister, its own portfolio, its own bureaucracy to oversee these growth corridors. Do you think that's something that the Labor government, the Albanese Labor government, would be amenable to?
Oh, I think the Labor government mantra is always about expanding bureaucracy, because that way you can control all of your own people, because they're all the beneficiaries, and all of them have got their snouts in the trough. And the bureaucrats at the moment, they're having a wonderful time. At the moment, most bureaucrats around the country are not working Mondays and Fridays. Well, sorry, they're working from home Monday and Friday, so they've perfected the long weekend, and there'll be a very little chance of getting to be totally productive on a Monday and Friday. And they're already not that productive anyway, most bureaucracies. And the mantra is coming, okay, well, we should actually have more bureaucracies. And that's part of the reason for the voice. Let's have another bureaucracy. The last thing we need in this country is more bureaucracies. It's just lunacy.
So you said before, you talked about a concept of logical expansion, which Australia doesn't do. Could you describe to us what you mean by that expression?
Well, I think no one actually, Damien, no one seems to be sitting down and saying, well, look, let's look at our opportunities as a nation going forward on an ascending scale. The top priority is energy. Now, the first question is, do we import our energy, such as wind turbines and solar panels, or do we use the stuff that's actually in the ground underneath our feet, which is nuclear, thorium, uranium, gas, oil, coal? Now, I'm just a dumb Scottish migrant, but I would rather use what I've got rather than try and buy and import something that is A, not reliable, B, that we can't afford as a nation. We should use what we've got. In terms of using the blue highway around the country, we should be doing that as opposed to saying, well, let's build another huge motorway, a freeway right around the nation with more lanes because there's more people coming and more traffic. We should use the blue highway. And in the top 30 that I have worked on, the number 28, number 29, and number 30 on my list was climate change aspects and the voice. But the government seems to be working from the bottom up, from down under, as Colin Hay would sing, "I'm the man from down under." So I think this is highly amusing that they're focusing on, and we should be focusing on priorities, or we should be prioritizing. But you need sensible people around the table that actually have run a business, have had to survive on their own skills and had to work 80 hours a week instead of bureaucrats that have been cruising all of their lives.
You gave a shout out to Colin Hay there, shout out to a fellow Scot, I might add. Is something about cultural identity, isn't there, that doesn't seem to factor into the debate? We're sort of stuck on this exponential growth, and we achieve growth now by these expanding suburbs and what's involved in delivering services to these suburbs, what it costs and what the employment it generates to build these suburbs. But do we owe something to the sense of cohesive sense of cultural identity that this nation used to have and is maybe under threat now because there is so many people coming from so many disparate groups?
Well, cultural identity, I think, when I first came here, it was a lot of fun, actually, because I came here as a teenager, as did Mr. Colin Hay and Jimmy Barnes. It was then you could actually learn how to swear in several languages very quickly. You would then learn how to take the mickey out of each other, which, of course, is absolutely forbidden now. Calling people pommy bastards or tight-ass Scots people or clog-hopping Dutch people. So, and that was actually a lot of fun because it was always done in good humor. And I think this nation has been a terrific example of integration of various nationalities and cultures. And to start criticizing that, oh, you're just all racist, you're anti this, anti that. I think that we've gone too far with that. And I think we should revert back to a bit of larrikinism and having a bit of fun and reminding us where we all came from.
We're talking to Stuart Ballantyne from the Royal Institution of Naval Architects, and we'll be chatting with him straight after we go to news. You're listening to TNT Radio.
TNT Radio News.
This is news.
Here we go.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Donald Trump has fired a fresh volley of shots at Joe Biden, mocking the 80-year-old president, who this week confirmed he's running for re-election in 2024. Attacks have intensified in Sudan, where the nation's top war commanders continue to fight each other for control of the country. And it's been revealed Washington has been gathering intelligence about talks between the German and Chinese militaries.
Silence for thinking differently?
Silence for thinking differently.
Not here. Silence for asking questions?
Not here.
Not here. Silence for discussing the other side of the story? Not on TNT Radio. Join the conversation anytime. Search TNT Radio on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Getter, or Gab. Download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Stuart, is this just basically a planning problem that councils aren't putting any forethought into where they're building? They're building suburbs ultimately on floodplains. And of course, there's going to be environmental problems with them. There would have been in any era.
Yes, there's a lot of areas that I've seen where they were building extensive housing. We've got part of our family down in Victoria, and I see just huge expansion of housing areas where there used to be a little bit of flooding. But of course, once you put the houses there and there's less drainage through the soil, it's going to become even a bigger problem. If it's close to a river, it still will become a big problem, and especially when the river is far from the sea. If you're close to the sea, there's very seldom you'll get a flood event close to the river mouth. But I see that most councils, they're almost looking after their own dung heap without looking at the big picture. So if you've got six or seven councils in the same geographic area, I don't think there's too much discussion between them. Occasionally here in Queensland, I've been to some of the mayor's meetings of the coastal towns. And in fact, I've addressed some of them on using the best use of their waterways and the best use of coastal transportation by ship. But then they can't get it through the green regulations that we have heaps of around the coast. So I think it's a myopic view by most councils.
Do you think it's difficult, isn't it? Because I know I grew up in a suburb and it was an outer suburb, Flagstaff Hill in South Australia for a little while, and there was no trees. It was like there was saplings. So on a hot day, there was nowhere to shade, and it was hot. There's no doubt about it, but it's a sunburnt country, as Dorothy McKellar says in her famous poem. Are we expecting something now from government that we would have never expected before. Like, there should just be perfect amenity. People should just be moving into these communities that are basically brand new suburbs. This is going to take some time for a culture to develop and build in these areas, isn't there?
That's for sure. And of course, you only get back 3 or 4 decades, and very few of the houses around the place were air conditioned. But now it's almost standard in every house, so that you have to have heating in the winter and air conditioning in the summer. And even the migrant camps, when I came to Geelong as a migrant kid, we were in Nissen huts near the Ford factory. And they were hot as hell on a hot day, and they were freezing cold on a cold day. So yes, we had about 10 months in a migrant camp, and you know, there was never anyone complaining about it. It was just, okay, that's what it is. Just suck it up. Get used to it. Now I see some of these illegal migrants who were stuck in Christmas Island moaning and groaning that their air conditioning wasn't working too well, and the gymnasium didn't have enough equipment. I thought, wow, these people don't know how they're living.
What is a sustainable population, in your opinion, or do you have an opinion? What's a sustainable number? Is there a figure for Australia, or are we just going to keep growing ad infinitum?
I think that, you know, when you look at the population, and when you fly across America, for instance, which is sort of geographically a similar size with, you know, not so much coastline, but certainly East Coast, West Coast, and you see all the cities in the middle. But again, what they did is the same as Canada. They extended their river system, such as the Mississippi and the ones up in the Great Lakes, that it became navigable. So all of the inland trapped, what we would call in this country, trap resources, were very cheap to actually get out. And that was, they did all of those canal developments, same as China, Russia, Germany, 160 to 200 years ago. We haven't addressed that yet. And if we really wanted to open up the middle, as Bob Katter has been saying for the last 30 years, we should have a canal system in Australia. We should be extending the waterways. And indeed, my little coffee group, the MTG, we pleaded with Kim Jong-un to send his ballistic missiles when he threatened to attack Australia. We said, well, look, if you send them all between the Gulf of Carpentaria and right down to Port Augusta, we'd be very appreciative of that, because it'll make a canal all the way through.
And that'd be the only way to get it done, through all the green tape, wouldn't it?
That's exactly right. Now, and we did tell them, look, in Port Augusta, they're used to explosions, because Miss Sarah Hanson-Young actually blew up the power station, or she was the politician behind that, blowing up their power station before they actually had sustainable energy with wind and solar. And that's when they started having the brownouts and blackouts in South Australia.
So I think the comparison with the US is an erroneous one to some extent, because Australia is it's an arid landscape, far more than the US landscape. It's like it's a desert basically in the middle, as far as the eye can see.
Yes, I think so. Again, coming back to the river system, and there's been lots of, like, the Bradfield scheme, I think it was actually quite brilliant. Bring irrigation. It would make the world's largest food bowl, but and John Bradfield himself, he was a man of vision. And we thought, well, it's a no-brainer. It is actually a no-brainer for this nation. So when Kevin Rudd actually declared that, you know, we were going through a bit of an economic hardship time, and we will inject $42 billion into Australia's most important project, I thought, got to be the Bradfield scheme. And no, it wasn't. It was the NBN. So you can download your porn on your faster. And I thought, I couldn't believe how dumb that was. And it was the level of decision making and the ALP at the time. So
it was always frightening that technology would catch up with it, wouldn't it? That's such a rollout, such a huge rollout, that the technological advances would actually outstrip the pace of the rollout itself.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Blind Freddy could see that. But, of course, politicians and the senior bureaucrats, when they get in a little gab fest and they start singing from the same song sheet, and with lots of people with their snouts in the trough following them, they say, oh, no, this is a good idea. We should, you know, be digging ditches right around Australia for the next 30 years. Doesn't matter that the technology will outpace us in 2 years. Doesn't matter about that. We'll just keep flogging the NBN, of course, and you've seen the blowout of the NBN budget. But they should have gone straight for the Bradfield scheme and made that whole set of bed the headwaters of the Murray-Darling. And this would have been a huge difference to our nation, and it wouldn't have been so arid.
Yeah, he wanted an information highway rather than a water highway. It was his legacy project in many respects, wasn't it? I mean, he had the apology, but I think he really thought this was nation building, the NBN. But maybe it was the wrong project, is what you're saying.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, even his apology, his effort to get the national sorry day, as I wrote recently in one of my columns in Spectator, I was hijacked by a Channel 9 crew walking through Sydney Airport, and dressed in a suit and a briefcase. And they said, excuse me, sir, would you like to give, I've got one of these stupid faces, Damien, that people, if they're collecting money or selling something.
That's why we got you on radio, mate. We got you on the radio.
Anyway, so this young lady from Channel 9, do you believe we should have a national sorry day? I said, oh, I certainly do. Oh, terrific. So she gets the camera crew and the lighting crew and the sound people around me. She said, good morning, sir. Do you believe we should have a national sorry day? I said, good morning, young lady. I certainly do believe we should have a national sorry day. But I don't think you'll get all those slimy bank managers in the same building at the same time. And she said, cut, cut. Yep. This is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the Aboriginal sorry.
I said, no, I bet you never saw yourself on the television. I bet you made it on the edit floor.
Yes, I was. I didn't scan Channel 9 that night because I knew it wouldn't be there.
Don't do it to yourself anyway, I would say. Stuart Ballantyne, thanks so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show.
Thanks, Damien.
Good to have you. You're listening to TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
You can't believe some of the stuff these people actually believe. I don't believe they believe it. We saw a testimony today from one of the administration officials that they want EV tanks. Tanks on the battlefield that are EV. Now, let me get this straight. Just imagine if you're a tank commander. When you yell, charge, it's going to have a different meaning now. And what of those charging stations? You're in a fight with the enemy. One of those great tank battles that used to occur, you know, Rommel, North Africa. Hours and hours and hours of tank battle. What do? Call the opposing commander up and say, hey, listen, we need a truce for 4 hours. I have to charge my tanks up. It's silly time. It really is. And I don't know when the general public of the entire planet is going to wake up to how they're being scammed. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Governments around the world are wasting billions of dollars in carbon capture and storage. Such programs oppose the benefit of enhanced photosynthesis for a greener world and improved crop yields. Much of the funding goes to geosequestration, which requires vast amounts of energy to pump carbon dioxide deep underground into geological formations. It would be better described as oxygen burial, given oxygen makes up 73% of the mass of carbon dioxide. For most of the last 600 million years of life on Earth, atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration exceeded 1,000 parts per million. And for much of that time, including when the dinosaurs roamed it, it was over 2,000 parts per million. Today, it is only about 415 parts per million. Burning fossil fuels liberates carbon back into the atmosphere from which it came.
It's time to switch on
today's news talk radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah. TNT.
Okay, it's all climate this hour because we're talking to Stuart Ballantyne about the day-to-day reality of dealing with the climate grifters in Australia that want money for everything. Everything needs to be mitigated against is because a result of climate. And you might say to yourself, where did this argument come from? what was its genesis? And that's why I've got my next guest on. He's going to actually dig deeper and I'm going to tell you exactly what the genesis of this whole climate scam is. His name is John McBride. He's a regular on the show and he grew up in an active Labor Party family. He gave up on the ALP after Keating's last term, which was just too woke for him. So he worked for a few years as a parliamentary advisor in the Victorian Legislative Council for a DLP, a Democratic Labor Party member. And John McBride, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks, Dane. Thanks for having me back.
Good to have you, mate. Now, just let's dig into this, get into this. What happened at the UN, this guy, Maurice Strong, who'd made all his fortune as a petrochemical billionaire but still considered himself a socialist somehow, got climate basically to be part of the UN's charter.
Yeah, so he's there in the 70s and the climate change agenda is his baby. And what he effectively did was he ran it as an agenda and the reason for it was that he wanted to get a tax base for the United Nations. See, the United Nations is funded by countries and they make pledges and then they send the money over and some are late and some don't pay and what have you. So Maurice's idea, and given that he was quite an astute businessman and obviously made billions of dollars, ironically enough, out of the petrochemical industry, he decided, well, the best thing to do is to produce something that will allow us to draw a tax on other nation states or the member states because they didn't have that power. So they're basically an administration, a supranational administration for the world. That's how they saw themselves and still do to this day, but without any tax base. And empires are built on tax bases, essentially. It's one of the definitions of an empire. So they were basically an empire without an income. And so this was Maurice Strong's great idea, a carbon tax. So if he could scare the hell out of the world and say that, look, carbon is driving the temperature, and therefore it's evil and we must decarbonize, but while we're doing it, the best way to do it is to run it as a each country pays us a percentage of the carbon tax that we'll get them to levy. And that was his it was really just a way of funding the United Nations without having to go through the process of cajoling countries to pay their bills.
So when Julia Gillard introduces the carbon tax under her stewardship, is she aware of this geezer, Maurice Strong, and she's absolutely highly aware of what she's doing it for, what the purpose of it is? Or does she genuinely think she's saving the planet?
No, part of the carbon. We paid 10% carbon tax under Julia Gillard, and 10% of that money that was collected under the carbon tax went directly to the United Nations. It was in the legislation. So She obviously knew what it was about because we were cutting a check to the United Nations based on that carbon tax.
I just want to know, how do they get away with it? How's that not presented to the Australian people? How is it just constantly sold, if this is the case, sold as something because there's a climate crisis, but no one's ever told, well, actually, there's this 10% that we're going to give to the UN as well because they're really, even if they say, oh, it's a really important institution, it's worthwhile, they might even sell it like that. There's nothing. You hear nothing about it. How's that possible? Don't we live in a democracy?
Well, how is it possible for Anthony Albanese to push the voice, but say, don't worry about the detail, don't worry about how it's going to function or fund or what role it's actually going to have. Just vote for it. I mean, it's essentially the same thing, isn't it? They didn't tell us. It was there in the legislation for those that read it. So it was, in a sense, the information was available, but no, they didn't spruik it. They certainly didn't inform us about it. But that's typical.
Well, the Fourth Estate didn't investigate on our behalf and get back to us with these reports either.
Well, the Fourth Estate's the idea of Fourth Estate is great, but in practice we don't have one. What we have is a supplying media empire that, owned and controlled by a few people. There's monopolies and oligopolies there and they're quite happy to massage the message and promote an agenda. So we're not being well served at all. And, of course, the generation of reporters that have come through, the last generation, they see themselves as activists rather than as journalists pursuing the truth.
Well, the Fourth Estate is back, John, and you're part of it right now. You are part of the Fourth Estate by doing this report in the first place.
Let's tell them the truth. See how that upsets them.
See how we go. But this strong character, in the end, he got chased out of the UN himself because he embezzled money. He embezzled some of the funds that he was going to use to help solve starvation, feed the world program, a food for oil program.
I doubt he's the first member of the United Nations that's had their hand in the cookie jar.
But he was already a billionaire. Did he need the extra?
Oh, look, I can't speak to what his soul was like. but look, he produced a lie. There's no actual physical science that supports the proposition that CO2 warms the earth, that it acts as a greenhouse gas, but so does every other gas that's up there. The question is it the most powerful greenhouse gas that physics has ever seen, or is it just a trace gas in there that does very, very little? And the truth is it's a trace gas that does very, very little. But you can't say that, because as soon as you say to them, show us the science, they go, no, science is settled. They said, 97% of scientists agreed with the original IPCC report. And that was the headline. You can probably still find it on the internet today. Someone dug into that and actually queried that, dug into the report and the scientists. And in fact, it's 3% of the scientists agree with the proposition. 97% didn't. So they've been lying to us from the start. And it's a lie. It's a lie that... it has purpose in produces a tax base for the UN, which of course they want, but it also hands power to governments. You couldn't get away with the 15-minute cities, and you couldn't get away with these councils putting their hands up for more money because the land's going to be flooded. It's a redistribution of wealth and a concentration of power in the hands of the state. The state gets to do things because they say, oh, look, we're doing it because of climate change. And you pointed out, well, it's not real. And they say, oh, look, climate denier. you deny the science. And you say, show us the science. Oh, no, the science is settled. And you go around in circles. And, of course, next, if you get effective at that, they'll censor you. They'll just kick you out of the public square, kick you off social media. Facebook will kick you off. Twitter is probably a bit better now under Musk, but the other... Google will stop you and stop searches. We've seen it. This is standard practice for the left. If they can't get their way, if their messaging is being threatened, they will smear you in the first instance, hoping that you just go away in despair because someone called you a bad name, or they will censor you. If you're really effective, they'll censor you. They'll get rid of you.
So what's in it for someone like Strong then? Ultimately, he's made his billions in petrochemical dollars. He's got money. He doesn't need – it's not money anymore. So it's purely the intoxication of power, is it?
Well, basically. I mean, imagine if you had every country with a carbon tax and the United Nations was getting 10% of that on a regular basis, you know, cutting a check every quarter. Their coffers would be full. And as a bureaucratic empire, the things they could do to help us, oh, it'd be amazing. all for the common good. Mm. You know, the junkets and the conferences and the new pieces of legislation. What sort of work do they do now? Well, they've written the back end of The Voice. You know, this is about indigenous rights. That's the back end of The Voice, and it's about stripping the assets back from Australia through that colonising process, as we formed colonies, took over land and issued land titles, and we did all those things, as all colonies do. It's about taking that back to year one, year zero, when it's like, no, you've all got to come back, sign this treaty, and then we'll tell you how much you have to pay us for that land. We want to renegotiate the war. It's
like... So these things are connected, aren't they? Like the climate debate, and now you're talking about The Voice. They're all actually interconnected because they're about UN control ultimately.
Hmm. Yeah, it's about their form of government. The whole idea of a nation state and democracies and people voting for stuff that affects their lives directly, that's anathema to these guys, to these they consider themselves well-placed to lead the world. It's they basically, what they're trying to implement is a neo-feudalism, and they are the new aristocracy.
You can't help but feel it's coordinated too, can you? Because I was talking to Nick Cater from the Menzies Institute yesterday on the show, and we're talking about this. There's a voice to Parliament that will be instituted soon. There's an assembly already in Victoria. There's a voice to Parliament already in South Australia, to the state parliament. So there'll be these state versions, you know, it's going to roll out across the country, that are going to talk to this federal version. It's a federation within a federation. There's two power sources, and what I've learnt from my readings about power, there's no way that two power sources can coexist like that. They're going to be in conflict with one another. So what's the result ultimately?
Well, the result, who will win? It will be the it's a war. I'm just trying to think of the union bloke who was running the Maritime Union when he came up against Patrick. And after Patrick had won and got the cranes in and the new wages and conditions and labour contracts in, he said to the Patrick bloke, he said, well, why didn't you just come to me initially and we could have done a deal? And he goes, no. He says, no one ever willingly hands over power. It has to be taken. And that's what we're seeing now. There's a cultural war, which is about the realignment of powers, who's in charge, who makes the decisions. And there's a movement there that would rather see, rather than the nation state of Australia, which we're told is white racist. We're all now white racist because we're living in a 200-year-old colony. It's that sovereignty thing that just they're against. They want all those restrictions to their power and the implementations of that power taken away. I mean, have a look at Justin Trudeau. He's out there now saying, "I never said that you had to have a mandate. I mandated the vaccines." And of course, it's so easy for people to go back and say, "Well, actually, you said it here, and here." But I point that out to say this. He's been, right now, he's still under a system that can hold him to account to some degree, right? So that he's got to come out and he's got to lie about it and try and rewrite history about what he actually did. But under the other model, the WHO would take over and through the United Nations, and they would implement the whatever regulations they want, and they would therefore police them too. So, and there'd be nothing we could do as a body politic to stop that because they're unelected.
See, Andrew Brigden in the British Parliament was calling out the WHO and the pandemic management treaty that the UK are going to sign with them, or potentially, and you know they'd be rolled out everywhere, and he's been expelled from the Conservative Party as a result of the position he's taken.
It's insane, isn't it? I mean, it is a parliamentarian whose whole job is to voice the concerns of his electorate, people that have voted for him, put him in place, and to represent those opinions, and he gets tossed out for having them. I mean, it's censorious, isn't it? I think we're at a very dangerous time in world history, to be honest. And have a look at Tucker Carlson. I love what he said the other day when he came out and he said, oh, basically, look, just keep speaking your truth calmly and politely and you will triumph over the evil. And I think that's correct. And you're going to get smeared for...
Do you really?
I think so.
Because in history, that hasn't been the case, has it? People have had to take up arms to make a difference. It hasn't been someone speaking calmly and honestly that's necessarily won the day. That's not how the Second World War was certainly won, or the First, or any campaign ultimately.
Well, we don't need to go to kinetic war to solve the problem, I don't think. Not yet. It's certainly on the horizon. Tucker's saying, and what I'm saying too, is that you've got to have the courage to actually speak the truth, and that not hysterically, and I think that was his point, You don't have to speak it hysterically. You just have to be committed to speaking the truth in the face of the lie. And you'll eventually, relentlessly, if you keep doing that, you'll get people joining you in the truth because they need to hear the truth. It's a war of narratives at the moment, and they're winning. But there is still the opportunity to push back. It's what TNT Radio is here, isn't it? To put the other narrative there, the competing narrative. You can't say this on mainstream media. ABC's not going to produce a documentary about it. So it's the citizen journalists and institutions like TNT Radio that are going to give voice to that other narrative, so that it can compete.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the criticisms of Tucker too, I find them spurious because, like, he was on a mainstream platform and he pushed up hard as he possibly could against that Overton window, harder than anyone else certainly was. That's for sure. That, you know, perfection's the enemy of the good. John McBride, I'm going to thank you for coming on the show and speaking the truth to the microphone. And it's always
thanks,
good.
Dan.
Always good to have you on. You're listening to TNT Radio.